the podcast for the midweek, and it's the Bob McCown Podcast, yours truly, along with John Shannon from Parts Unknown. And joining us, the longtime voice of hockey in the United States, and familiar to many people in Canada as well, Mike Emmerich, better known as Doc to his friends, has announced his retirement, at least for the moment, from broadcasting and sports. I say that, Emmerich, because we are all aware that once you get into this crazy business, the notion of retirement is one that is constantly in the back of your mind. And the experiences have been that after a little while, you figure, maybe I did this too soon. How are you dealing with it? I mean, it's just a few days now, but are you okay with it?
Oh, yes, I am. People that have retired kept telling me that I would know when it was time to retire. And between the second and third round of the playoffs this year, it came to me that I just knew that this was the right time. And some of it had to do, Bob, with round numbers, that I had seen my first game 60 years ago, and 50 years ago I'd covered my first NHL game officially as a reporter, and 40 years ago I started doing NHL games on television. And then in the midst of the pandemic, NBC took such good care of me by allowing me to have a studio in my house and doing all that complicated syncing that needed to be done so that I could actually call games live off of a monitor.
Right.
And to have that opportunity was somewhat awesome. And it also made me reflect back to the point that, hey, this has been wonderful. I'm still healthy. My wife is still healthy. And it's a good time in my life. And this is it. So they've allowed me to stay on and do essays and videos and things like that. So I still get a team jersey and I'm able to keep my hand in. And I think that will remove any temptation. As you know, we all go kicking and screaming seemingly to get away from broadcasting, but this keeps my hand in. And I think it would remove any temptation in wanting to go back and do play-by-play.
I don't know if you can even answer this question, Mike, but if we had not been in this pandemic, if the circumstances were normal this year, do you think your decision would have been the same one?
It's a tough hypothetical question. I once worked alongside a gentleman named Lou Lamorello who said, mm-hmm. I never answer hypothetical questions, but I'll try to answer it anyway. I think I probably would have still said that I would have probably considered this to be the rounding off point in a career, just because I had the fortune of working with so many great people and doing a lot of games over 3,700. And I think it would have been, but I don't know, because I still feel great. And that's the temptation that you always have. Well, I'll go back for another one, because we never want to give up seemingly. But no, this just felt right. And the last chapter of the book that I wrote, at the time that I was writing it with Kevin Allen, was called The Last Elevator Ride. And it was projecting into the future when I would retire. And it was talking about the last being there for the last Stanley Cup being handed out, hopefully in an arena that the home team won. Well, of course, it didn't happen. Nothing happened the way that we thought it would this year, but this was the right time for me. And so coincidentally, the target date for releasing the book was this past Tuesday, and it was decided upon 6 months ago, long before any of this other came to my mind. Just bizarre. But it's 2020. I guess we're full of bizarre this year.
Yeah.
But I mean, let's face it, Mike, the whole concept of things ever changing is how you do play-by-play. You adapt to the environment you're in, and being able to adapt to it the way you did, heck, even in the last four rounds of the Stanley Cup playoffs, tells you that nothing really has changed, even though we think it has changed.
Oh, true. The far winger calling a game from home is like the far winger calling a game from Madison Square Garden. You're going off, sure. You're going off 4 inches of a sleeve number, and an 8 and a 9 are only a half inch of cloth. And just as people that you worked with, John, agonized over misidentifying a player that was wearing an 8 or a 9 that looked the same because they all had helmets on back when helmets were introduced as mandatory in 79. You still get aggravated about things like that. But the far winger inside an arena was just as hard as the far winger off a TV screen. And it's an imperfect science. And I finished up never having done a perfect game. I wish I could have, but in trying to do a perfect game, it was a mistake to try to do.
How did you keep it a secret? Because even your closest of friends were surprised on Monday.
Yeah, well, Joyce kept the secret really well. She had known it as long as I had, because the day that I decided, I went up and told her, this is it. And her reaction was, because she had kind of sensed that off and on every year, this was the Walter Alston contract with NBC for the last 8 years. Every year I told them whether I was coming back or not, and it was a 1-year deal. And she said, are you sure? And I said, I really am sure this time that this is it. And so she kept it to herself, and my business manager, Lou Oppenheim, kept it to himself. And then 1 week ago, we had the telephone call with Sam Flood from NBC, and he kept it within a very small group because his idea was, let's produce a going away video that we can also release at the same time that we do the written press release about this. Well, that required involving 2 or 3 more people to edit it, who were also assigned to the NFL to edit pieces for them. So it did involve, by the time it was done, 8 or 9 people. But yeah, it was kept quiet. I didn't want to deal with it, even though I'd made the decision a month or so ago, I didn't want to deal with it during the playoffs because the athletes are the story at that time, and they're the story at the draft, and they're the story in free agency. And so the number of opportunities that I would have had to actually make this public were less in my mind, just because that's the time that the athletes need to have the story exclusively theirs, and not somebody that broadcast hockey games. So that was why.
You've done NFL football, you've done college basketball, the Olympics, a bunch of other stuff. But hockey was, it seems, your focus from the beginning of your career.
And don't
career.
Forget, he loves the Pirates. There's the Pirates. There's always Pirates.
Yeah. Well, but was it intentional, you getting into hockey very soon after you got out of school?
Yes, it was intentional from the time I was 14. There are a lot of people in all across this world that see their first game and get hooked by it, and they become fans. And for me, I wanted to be a baseball announcer until I saw my first game in Fort Wayne 60 years ago, Fort Wayne and Muskegon. And a guy named Con Madigan played in the game. And I
Mad
still
Dog.
Hear... What?
Mad Dog Madigan.
Yeah, that's right. And I still hear from Con Madigan once in a while, and I'm so glad of that. Anyway, he played in the game, scored a goal with the goalie pulled in the last minute, skated around the ice backwards, and had a fight with 2 seconds left in the 10-minute sudden death overtime. And I was just thoroughly entertained. I didn't know icing or offside, and I didn't care because there were actual fights. And I was a wrestling fan, and I thought, this hockey is wonderful. I had seen some games on CBS because they had the NHL package at the time. And I had seen some of the Olympic games early in the year and that miracle team that won at Squaw Valley against Harry Sinden and some of the Canadian players that were there in Squaw Valley that year. But I hadn't really seen professional hockey live ever until that night. And I walked away from that and I changed my career vocation. You can imagine going into a guidance counselor as a high school student saying, I want to be a hockey announcer.
Yeah.
And the kind of look that you might have gotten in rural Indiana, but that's what I wanted to be. So the change was made very early in my life. And I just got lucky enough to get to do it.
Yeah, the in reading a lot of the stuff the last couple of days, there's one person that really had an early impact on you. And that's someone I wouldn't have assumed was part of that. And that was Ed Snyder. And what Ed Snyder meant to your career.
Well, he did. He gave me a job through a guy named Gil Stein, who was the last president of the NHL in Portland, Maine, in the American League. I had been in Port Huron for 4 years, and each year the team was owned by the city, which made it a political football. And every summer there were losses, of course, to explain to the city. And every year there was a question about whether the team in the IHL would be back. It was that proud jersey I have behind me right now. And so there was an uncertainty about it. And yet the Flyers had just won a couple of championships, and they put a team in Portland, Maine in the American League because they were tired of sharing an arrangement in Springfield. And so it was going to be bankrolled and it was going to be wealthy, and there was not going to be financial uncertainty. And Gil Stein was assigned to be president of the Mariners, and he was president of the Flyers at the time too. And so he went through and conducted all the interviews of potential broadcasters and PR guys. And I finished second. And then he changed his mind because he had sent all the tapes into Philadelphia, and they had chosen another person to finish first. And I finished second, and then he overruled the broadcast person in Philadelphia and said, I want this guy because I saw him work at our press conference when he was here to cover Bob McCammon being hired as our coach. And so I was there and changed my life around because I got a chance to be with a team that not only won two championships in a row, but also was progressive minded. They did hire from within. And after 3 years in Maine, I wound up going to Philadelphia. And that was 40 years ago when I got to do my first NHL game. It was a preseason game between the Flyers and the Canadiens, the last game of the preseason schedule, which means all the cuts had been made. And I recognized everybody on the ice, because I was an NHL fan and there were very few helmets. Mm-hmm. Big Bird, Larry Robinson, Bobby Clark, I mean, Bill Barber, the hair was flying around and you could identify every guy.
With Mike Doc Emmerich, the preeminent voice of hockey in America for a long time, I'm intrigued often by how, and as I alluded to in the previous question, about how people get started and who are the influences that they have. I had the great privilege of working for Foster Hewitt at his radio station at the beginning of my career. But I can't say that Foster was, he was an idol, but I didn't pattern anything after him. I don't think you could have. Who was it for you? When you started listening to hockey games, Mike, who was it that jumped out and you said, yeah, that's a sound that I want to try and emulate?
Well, first it was Bob Chase in Fort Wayne, and he was on a 50,000 watt radio station, and I was only 40 miles away, and I was a Comets fan because of that first game, and I had listened to him even before I went. And so that was it. And I've talked to players that eventually become coaches and have asked them who they're like as they start to learn how to coach, and they will tell me that they're hybrids of the guys they played for. I think that's the style that you first start out with when you're an announcer too. It's the guys you've listened to, and I think that's what you're alluding to, Bob.
Sure.
So it was Bob Chase, and then eventually it was Gene Hart, whose rat-a-tat-tat sort of radio call was what I admired too. And then it became Danny Gallivan, who John worked with for years. And I admired so much how he could turn a phrase and his vocabulary and how he could work a sense of humor into the broadcasts as well. And when I was with the Maine Mariners in the late 70s, we would go into Halifax to play Montreal's farm team, the Nova Scotia Voyagers, and they would be delightful 3.5 hour games because you could empty the benches back then. I mean, it was just glorious. But on Saturday nights, we would be off in Halifax because you didn't go up against Hockey Night in Canada. And Terry Murray, one of our defensemen, who later, of course, coached in the NHL, and I were big fans of Danny Gallivan, and we would hope that the assigned game that we could watch in Halifax was going to be a Canadiens game, and Danny would be calling it. And sure enough, we would get such phrases as, "And now then, John Stone for the Rangers left the puck behind, a necessity for scoring most times." Or we would get, "And now then, Napier through center to Pat Hughes," Robinson through center to Napier, "who will marry Pat Hughes' sister in June." And on that matrimonial note, the Canadians arrive at the North Stars line. I mean, who wouldn't love that? But we had hoped that we would get here Danny on a Saturday night in Halifax, and many times we did.
Wow.
And, of course, you can tell as many stories as far more than I, because
he
can. With the guy.
Well, here, you know, this is not about me, so it's about you. But you've also got to work with some great people, and you've got to learn from some great people. I watched some video the other night, you and Bill Clement, you and John Davidson, you and Herb Brooks. You've touched a lot of people that were your partners as well and made them better.
I've been lucky. Yeah, I have. And Bill Raftery doing basketball, and Matt Millen and Hank Stram doing football, they all made me better because I had to learn on the fly with those sports. I'd done them in college, but you know, a lot of us got to do college athletics, but it's a lot different when you're in the pro game. And those people were very kind to take me under their wing and let me learn from them. So I was very fortunate, John. And the first ever game that I ever did to an audience was radio at Bowling Green, and it was Bowling Green and the Ryerson Rams.
All right.
Oh my God.
That was my old school.
My old school.
We used to get, because the Central Collegiate Hockey Association was only four teams,
right?
You couldn't very well make a schedule up with only playing conference games. So Jack Vivian, our coach at Bowling Green, would always invite a lot of Canadian schools to come in. And there were a lot of very aggressive players on some of those Canadian colleges because you were allowed to fight in Canada. And if you fought in CCHA games, well, you'd get ejected for the game and then suspended the next two. We had some just blistering games with Guelph and Western Ontario and some of those teams, and we'd have to fight, and it would be just ornery.
Monday in your press call, it was always interrupted by people. Gary got on, Lou got on, Eddie got on. So we thought we would match that.
Oh.
So I have a friend in St. John's, Newfoundland, who retired last year. And Bob Cole, when I talked to him yesterday, I said, "Mike's retired." He said, "What? Why would he do that?" So Bob is here. Why don't you tell Bob, who, to me, you guys are on Mount Rushmore.
Oh, my.
Two of the Mount Rushmore faces of hockey play-by-play, and Bob Cole is here. And
John
Bob,
Shannon.
How are you, sir?
Mr. Cole, can you hear us? Well, he's getting himself ready. This is extraordinary. And I've got to tell you, Mr. Emmerich, even I was not aware that this was going to happen.
That's wonderful.
This is a little surprise that Shannon has cooked.
I used to be a producer, you know.
Was he any good as a producer, Emmerich? Tell the honest to God truth.
Oh, yes. Yes, he was. We worked especially several times earlier, but it was Sports Channel America in 88 and 89 during the final. And the teases that he assembled were not only lengthy, but they were all magical. And they were intricate, but magical. And the production staff would do two or three takes on them, but they all came out looking great by the time the game started. And he said, you know, we do these teases for people in the truck. I don't know that the people at home care about them, but we do. And they get us started off right.
And years later, our mutual friend Don Cherry would say, John, nobody watches the openings.
But we did, and so that was why it was worth doing.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, Bob, can you hear us? Mr. Cole, are you there? We can see you. I don't think he can hear us.
Oh, darn. Unmute the mic.
Well, I don't know what we can do in the middle of the broadcast except carry on and hope he figures
it out. It was such a noble thought, though.
Well, it's like one of my openings, Mike.
Well, he's looking and thinking, and it looks like he wants to say something, but not as yet. Hopefully he can.
Tell him thanks so much for the thought. I do apologize, and I'm sorry that it didn't get on here. That my apology is the fact that I have
to... Oh, you got time. You got to go.
In about 4 minutes, I have to reconnect with Boston. But I have about 4 minutes if it works out.
Well, anything else, John? I want to, you know.
No,
you told me, and you're my producer, John.
Yeah,
and you told me to hold that up.
Yeah.
So that I'll do. Okay.
Yeah, and how fortunate it is you have a nice simple name for your title. That didn't take long to pick the title of the book.
No, it didn't. It's one that I used for radio shows about 30 years ago, so it came pretty easy.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's great that Sam and the guys at NBC are going to have you do essays, because our first real connection was in the early 80s when I was living in Western Canada, and I commissioned you to do 10 features for us.
Yes, you did. And I never forgot that.
So to have you start your career with me doing features, and next year you're going to finish it doing features, that to me is, that's a good story.
It is. Yeah, we had a lot of fun together, and we still will.
Absolutely, Doc.
You're going to have it. You'll have me back, right?
Anytime you want, we'll be in touch.
Okay.
All right, man.
Thanks, Doc. And
Thank you.
Congratulations on a great career. And we're so appreciative of your time today. And we'll look forward to talking to you down the road.
Thank you so much. And please tell that gentleman out there in Newfoundland that I admire him greatly and thank him for calling in.
There is Mike Doc Emmerich, retired, as unquestionably the voice of hockey in America. And we'll talk to certainly one of the voices of hockey in this country. Bob Cole, hopefully will connect with us when we come back after this message. Well, we were hopeful to get Mike Emmerich on with our next guest, and you saw him, and you can see him right now if you're watching on YouTube. The legendary Bob Cole is with us. Robert, how's retirement?
Good morning. It's retirement is working just like this connection is working today, Bob.
Well, you know, when you've got John Shannon trying to pull the strings and produce something, you know it's gonna get messed up. You know that, don't you?
Well, it happened though. I'm amazed. Patience is a virtue.
Well, which the three of us have none, for sure.
Virtue or patience?
Both. We just talked to Mike Emmerich, Bob, and he's announced his retirement. You did the same thing last year. Would you be able to explain the angst that you go through of missing the game, that Mike will end up missing the game?
I am so sorry to hear that Mike has packed it in. I love listening to Mike, and I've watched him a lot. He's great. But I guess time comes for everything and everybody. And I don't recall, John, between you and me and Robert, of mentioning the word retirement. I have never done that.
I stand corrected. Okay, just like the game of hockey, you are on pause. How's that?
All right, on pause, still waiting. And this is the first phone call I've had, and nothing has we had a tough time connecting on this one. So I guess I'm reading something.
In part of our discussion with Mike, he talked about the influence of Danny Gallivan on his career. So maybe that's something other than play-by-play that you and Mike have in common.
I think we all look to Danny Gallivan when Danny was broadcasting hockey with the Canadiens, and they were so successful with 20-something cups. And hockey was great. I think it was better for the fan back then than it is today. Now you might ask me why is that. I don't know. I think the game is probably much too fast now. And I don't think the players enjoy it like they used to. You know, you don't see any end-to-end rushes anymore. That's done. The coaching is so fantastic. They have video. They study everything. You can introduce new rules. They'll find a way to beat it. And on it goes. The old days are gone, and I'm not sure that's good.
You obviously had the opportunity, as we did, Mr. Cole, to watch this new version of sports that exists now with this pandemic around us. Was there a tangible difference from you sitting at home watching hockey games where there was nobody in the stands?
That's a great question, and I'm not sure if I have a correct answer. But I think the league did a great job in trying to show that the game is the same no matter if there are fans there or not. They had some crowd noise pumped in, and
yeah,
they operated that very well. Somebody was doing a good job, and I don't know. It'll never be the same, Bob. You know that. But they tried, and I commend them.
Okay, so let's get to the brass tacks. We talked to Emmerich, and we mentioned that he loves the Pittsburgh Pirates. What the heck happened to your New York Yankees?
I don't know. They've been going downhill for a while now, and it's not the same without the Yankees. Let's face it. You love them or you hate them. And it was great baseball. And I left last night's game, and I think the sixth inning when the hits were coming back-to-back fast and furiously, I quit.
Well, you gave up because the Dodgers were putting a whooping on Tampa Bay. That's what you know, I mean, it wasn't a game anymore. It was over.
Yes, you're darn right. It was over. The hockey was, both coaches did a great job, I think. Cooper, bonus. They'll never have another series like that, I don't think. And you mentioned, Bob, no fans. It makes a difference to hear the crowd, and it gets the fan into the game. It gets the players into the game, and I don't know. It's so different, and hopefully it'll be cleared up soon.
Hey, talk. That's an interesting thought, because how much of a crowd response, because you, in the years that you did play-by-play for Hockey Night, you were in some really quiet buildings, and then in playoffs, you were in some really noisy buildings. But how did that affect your play-by-play?
Another great question. I don't know, to tell you the truth. John, it must have affected it because it's part of the game, the fans, the crowd. It gives you goosebumps at the right time with the right play and the right player. Plur, as Danny would say, coming out of his own zone gingerly down the right side and on and on and on and scoring the goal that was so big, and the crowd with the play all the way, and it's hockey. Hockey is the greatest game in the world, but you got to have the fans.
Do you recall, Mr. Cole, the smallest attendance at a game that you called? Just an approximation.
Oh, wow.
I mean, there were a few arenas. There have been a few arenas out there that have been a lot less than full from time to time. And I'm just wondering if there's one night that stands out to you.
No, not in that respect. But I do recall one game that I called the play-by-play of a Stanley Cup game. John will come up with this quickly. Watch. And I couldn't see the other end of the rink. Our Chin 4 broadcasting was over 200 feet away. It had us up behind one goal. And that was the night that the fog came into the building. And I couldn't see the other end for about 7 or 8 seconds.
Yeah, so it was Buffalo, Buffalo in 1975. So.
There you go, John. Yeah.
I tell you what, Bob. You and I were part of a game early in our careers. In fact, it might have been one of the first times we ever worked together. We were at the Olympia in Detroit. That's how long ago it was. That's two arenas ago. And it was a super series. Ted Lindsay was your color man. And there had to be 4,000 people at Olympia that night because it wasn't part of the season ticket package. And it was the Red Wings against a team from
Czech
Republic.
Yeah.
And the only thing that was more distracting than no people in the stands was the protest against the Iron Curtain and the local Czech public did in Detroit that night with giant posters and giant banners walking around the concourse. And Vasilev Nedimansky was playing for the Red Wings, which is why they put that team in Detroit. But that was the smallest crowd I ever recall being with you in any building.
I think you're right on the money again, John. Mr. Lindsay was, as you say, the color man. I don't think he's ever done it before. And we were together in Olympia. And unlike color people today on a hockey broadcast, it was so difficult to get him to say anything. He just enjoyed the game and didn't want to talk too much. But, everybody remembers Ted Lindsay. What a great hockey player, and what a great man.
Yeah. I will tell you, Bob McCowan, I was in the booth that night. That was the toughest booth I'd ever been in, between Bob Cole and Ted Lindsay. If I had gone to any bar in Detroit, I knew I was protected between both guys.
I was going to say, fisticuffs did not break out in the booth between the two of them, did it?
No, there was a mutual respect, but let's put it this way. Both of them knew exactly what they were doing.
Well, all right. On the subject of small attendance and quiet buildings, here's a question I've never asked Mr. Cole in our numerous discussions. It is oft said that Toronto hockey fans are the quietest hockey fans, until you get to the playoffs, and then things change a little bit. But during a regular season, the quote-unquote corporate crowd that dominates the scene at Maple Leaf Gardens, then the Air Canada Centre, now Scotiabank, but at the Toronto Arena, is the quietest in the NHL. True or false, Mr. Cole?
True.
It is.
Take your time, Bob.
Definitively and unapologetically, it is true. Yeah.
Yeah.
Bob? I recall back 2 years, Brof was the coach, and he brought some jump to the building. I think the Leafs were playing St. Louis in the playoffs. John, you'll recall that playoff series. A lot of the fans, you mentioned, Bob, gave up their season tickets. They're gone to Florida, wherever they're gone. But they left the hockey because the Leafs weren't very good. But Brophy did a job on them somehow. it became very exciting. And for once, and I think only once, the crowd at Maple Leaf Gardens was outstanding. These were people who never did get into Maple Leaf Gardens to see a hockey game because you can't get a ticket, right?
Yeah.
They're all sold. And fans are great. They attend the game. But you're right, Bob. They're very quiet.
Well,
it's getting better.
Hopefully. You're chortling, Shannon. Is it getting better in your opinion, Shannon?
No, it's not. It's not changed a bit.
Still the same, so, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's I think other than Montreal, because I think Montreal have the best hockey fans in the world, particularly on Saturday nights, and Bob Cole knows all about that. I think that most Canadian cities are ones that they think they know so much about the game they want to sit back and analyze rather than cheer.
But I would think, guys, that the corporate crowd in Montreal is not dissimilar to the corporate crowd in Toronto.
I think it disappeared, Bob. I think when a few things happened, I think that corporate dollar disappeared and really in the late 90s, early 2000s, when Canadians were really struggling, they reinvented and reinvigorated the market with real young hockey fans. And Bell Center is the place to be. In my mind, if I pick two buildings, because I have one that I love personally, and then I would go to Bell Center. I'd also go to MSG. I love watching hockey games at MSG with that fan base.
Mr. Cole's kind of smirking. What's your favorite building to do a game in?
I knew he was going to say Madison Square Garden, of course. But New York is New York, and I don't blame John for that. It's a great place for sport. Yankees, Rangers. And look out, the Rangers are coming on as we speak. The number one draft pick, that's going to help them. And, of course, Glenn Saver still has his hand in the workings of the Rangers. Glad to see that.
Hold on. You're going to get JD on the phone. He's going to be mad. He's going to say, Bob thinks Slats is running everything. It's your old pal, John Davidson, now. Come on.
No, I was getting to John Davidson. You just didn't give me a chance. But Slats was the guy I recall turning the Rangers around. Yes. And like he turned Edmonton around. Like he won these Stanley Cups. And Slats is a great hockey man. Always was. And now John Davidson, he's come along all the way from color with the Maple Leafs and Hockey Night in Canada and working for you, John, in those great glory years. And then on and on and on he goes. And he's another great success story. And look out for the Rangers.
Well, I can't. I mean, this love affair that you two have is delightful. But I can't participate in this conversation.
No, so, you can't. So
I'm just going to shut up. And so the two of you just yak between yourselves.
We don't have to go much longer. The reason we got Bob on originally was to pay
tribute. Well, to talk about Doc and to say hello to Doc. Yeah.
So and as I told you yesterday, Bob, when we first talked, I said, somebody asked me on social media who the Mount Rushmore of broadcasters of hockey are. And I couldn't name four, because I think there are more than four. And it was you and Emmerich and Gallivan and Kelly and Jimmy Robson, who was my boyhood idol in Vancouver and has did a marvelous job for so many years, and René Lecavalier. So Mount Rushmore in hockey has six faces on it, not just four like they do in South Dakota.
And you don't have Foster?
No. I don't because I'm not taking anything away from Foster being first. He was first and he will always be first and they can't take away from him. But his play-by-play is nowhere near as good as yours ever was.
No, John.
No, never. And I worked with Foster too. And I worked with Billy too. And they were beautiful people. But if you wanted a big game, and you said you gave me a list of eight or nine people, Foster and Bill would be eight and nine.
Okay. He's tough, Bob.
He's annoying.
Some time ago, I remember a conversation you and John had about Tiger, who's back tomorrow, I'm glad to hear. And you were saying how Tiger's swing is coming back just like it used to be, and you were right.
Yeah, well, I like the tempo that he has now. It's it reminds me of when he was 17 years old and at Stanford and winning U.S. amateur championships. And the problem with golfers, I think we all know, is that we are constantly tinkering with our swing, no matter how good we think it is. We think it can be better. And Tiger is one of those guys who just constantly believes there's more that he can get. And if one teacher won't teach him, he goes and gets another one. I don't know how many he's had, 5, 6, 7. You know, Butch, Haney, two of the best in the world, and he fired both of them. But his swing now, I think, is as good as it's ever been. His putting is not as good as it was, and his age will not allow him to be the great player he once was. But he's still pretty entertaining.
Agree? Yes. You said it all. Oh, for goodness sakes. I can't wait to see him tomorrow. And like you, I hope he does well. And for whatever reason it is, when Tiger is on his game, golf is another picture, another story. It's outstanding. It's a tough sport.
Mr. Cole, we're going to let you go. We're glad we got you on, finally, after much consternation on Shannon's part. Who, of course, was a fine producer, but technically hasn't got a clue as to what's going on. And evidence
got it working, though. I got to hand it to him.
Well,
there you go.
Yeah, we got you on the phone. So, but here's what we're going to do. We're going to take a little time, and then we're going to get you back, and hopefully we'll do it with the whole enchilada here with your system working, and we'll have a nice long chat about a whole bunch of stuff, okay?
Very good, Bob. It's great talking to you. Great seeing you again. You too, John.
Any more Tim Hortons commercials coming?
I hope so.
Attaboy.
Well, yeah, because I heard you through the whole playoffs. You did more. You were on more games than anybody else.
It's a great Canadian company. It was a pleasure working with them. They're all great people.
Doc Emmerich earlier on, a couple days after he announced his retirement, and the legendary Bob Cole with us here in the second half. We thank you all for watching or listening. We'll see you Friday on the podcast. Bye-bye.